Bag huge savings on your painting projects at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim, and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect choice for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. DuraFighter interior paint starts at $27.75 a gallon. Get an additional 15% savings on all Dutch Boy paints when you put it in the bag. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. So if you are getting ready for clinicals or you're just trying to get a handle on the absolute mountain of information that is pharmacology, you know how we do it here.
We take all that source material, the textbooks, the drug guides, all the dense research, and we try to boil it down.
Right. We strip it down to the stuff that you actually need to know for patient care, the high-yield knowledge.
And today we're tackling a huge one. Antibacterial pharmacology. I mean, for anyone just starting out in practice, giving these drugs safely is, well, it's one of your biggest and most immediate responsibilities.
Oh, absolutely. It can feel so overwhelming. It's less like learning a science and more like just trying to memorize this phone book of weird chemical names and potential disasters.
And that's what we want to fix today. Our whole mission here is to move past the rote memorization. We're going to break down 9 major classes of these drugs.
And we're going to focus on the why. You know, how they actually work.
Exactly. The why, the mechanism, and then the so what. What does this mean for you at the bedside as a nurse? What's the immediate life-saving thing you need to do?
We want you to see the logic behind it all. Why the way a bacteria is built changes which drug you pick.
And how these tiny differences at a molecular level translate directly into, say, needing to check a trough level, or telling a patient to stay out of the sun, or making that split-second decision to stop an infusion.
This whole deep dive is designed to turn those complicated drug names into really a set of vital patient safety checkpoints.
And we have to start at the very, very beginning.
Yep. You can't know how to kill the bug until you know how the bug is built.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's unpack this. It's a foundational concept, and I feel like sometimes people dismiss it as just microbiology, but it is so critical for antibiotic selection. I'm talking about gram-positive versus gram-negative bacteria.
It is, hands down, the most critical concept for starting the right therapy. If you pick a drug that can't even get inside the bacteria, well, you're not going to have a good outcome.
Right. It's like having the wrong key for a lock.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So let's start with gram-positive bacteria. The way to visualize these is to think of them as being protected by a single, really thick fortress wall.
Okay, a big wall.
A big, thick wall made mostly of something called peptidoglycan.
And because that peptidoglycan layer is right on the outside and it's so thick, that makes it a really good target, doesn't it?
It's the perfect target. It's accessible. It's thick. And that's exactly why so many of our classic workhorse antibiotics, I'm thinking of the beta-lactams, like penicillin, are so effective against them.
They can just get right to that wall and start breaking it down.
They can get right to it and disrupt the structure. Now, they come in different shapes. You know, some are spheres, we call those cauchy, some are rods, which are bacilli. But the main thing to remember is that big, thick, targetable wall.
Okay, so that's the single-layer fortress. Now, let's talk about the ones that cause all the headaches. The gram-negative bacteria.
Yes. This is where things get a lot more complex and, frankly, a lot more challenging from a medical standpoint.
So what's different about their structure?
Instead of that one thick wall, you should think of them as having a double membrane structure. They have an outer membrane that acts like a shield, and underneath that is a much thinner layer of peptidoglycan.
Ah, okay. So the antibiotic has to get past that outer shield first just to get to a target that's already smaller and less ideal.
Exactly. That outer membrane is super restrictive and makes it so much harder for certain drugs, especially some of the older ones that are designed to attack the cell wall, to even get in.
And that's a big reason why they're so good at developing resistance.
It's a primary reason. That double barrier is a huge problem. And that outer membrane has something in it that makes these infections so dangerous so quickly.
You're talking about lipopolysaccharide, LPS.
That's the one. We often call it endotoxin. And it is a powerful, powerful trigger for our immune system.
So what happens when, you know, we give an antibiotic, the bacteria die, and all this LPS gets released into the body?
You get a massive, uncontrolled inflammatory cascade. The body just overreacts. And that's why gram-negative infections are so notorious for spiraling into sepsis or systemic inflammatory response syndrome, psoriasis, and, you know, potentially fatal toxic shock.
It's a direct result of the body's reaction to the bacteria's own structure.
It is. And to make matters worse, they love to form biofilms, which are these sticky, hard-to-penetrate communities of bacteria that just make treatment even harder.
So let's drill down a bit on the specific clinical threats here, starting with the gram-negative risks.
With gram-negative, you have to be thinking about immediate systemic collapse. They are a major cause of bloodstream infections in hospitals. You have the Enterobacteriaceae family.
That's things like E. coli and Klebsiella.
Right, and they cause that whole spectrum of serious infections we see all the time. Complicated UTIs, really aggressive pneumonias, meningitis, and of course, endotoxic shock. You can watch a patient just decompensate so fast because of that LPS release.
Okay, so now let's flick to the gram-positive side. They don't have that double membrane, but they are definitely not harmless. And the big one here is Staphylococcus aureus.
Oh, S. aureus is an incredibly tough pathogen. It causes a huge range of problems. Everything from, you know, simple skin abscesses to really devastating infections deep inside the body like pneumonia or endocarditis, which is an infection of the heart valves.
Septic arthritis, osteomyelitis, bone infections.
All of it. And while the gram-negative bugs cause endotoxic shock with LPS, S. aureus has its own version of toxic shock syndrome, and it looks differently.
That's a really crucial distinction for a nurse to make.
It is. S. aureus causes toxic shock syndrome, or TSS, using something called a superantigen toxin. The most famous one is toxic shock syndrome toxin 1. When that's circulating, the patient gets very sick very fast.
So what are the telltale signs of TSS from S. aureus that a nurse needs to be looking for?
You're going to see a really rapid onset of a high fever. That's usually paired with severe diarrhea, muscle pain, and this very distinct sunburn-like rash.
And the rash is key, right? Especially where it shows up.
It's characteristic. You'll often see it on the palms of the hands and the soles of the feet. This patient is critically ill. Recognizing that rash plus the other symptoms is a life-saving assessment.
So the big takeaway here is that no matter the gram stain, if the immune system can't handle it, you're headed for a systemic disaster.
Absolutely. And our job is to know the different triggers, LPS versus that TSS toxin, and get the right antibiotic in before that collapse happens. It's a high-stakes situation.
Okay, so we've covered the bacterial architecture. Let's move on and talk about how we actually destroy their internal machinery. This next section is all about drugs that go after the bacterial ribosomes.
Right, the protein factories. The little machines that build everything the bacteria needs to survive and to replicate.
And there are two main targets inside that ribosome.
There are. We can target the 30S ribosomal subunit or the 50S ribosomal subunit. And thankfully, they're different enough from our own human ribosomes that we can attack them without doing too much damage to our own cells.
So let's start with the drugs that block that smaller 30S subunit. We're talking about the tetracyclines, doxycycline, minocycline.
Yep. The mechanism here is pretty straightforward. They physically stop the bacteria from making proteins. They act like a blockade on that 30S subunit.
How does that work exactly?
Well, they prevent the transfer RNA, the tRNA, from attaching. The tRNA is what carries the amino acid building blocks. So if it can't dock and deliver the materials, protein construction just stops.
And their scope is huge. They're broad spectrum. They hit gram positives, gram negatives, and a lot of those atypical organisms that other drugs miss.
Their utility is just vast. They get into all sorts of body tissues really well. So we use them for respiratory infections, for STIs, for long-term treatment of acne, and really critically for tick-borne illnesses like Lyme disease.
Right. And because tetracyclines bind to calcium, that immediately creates a massive high-yield nursing alert.
This is non-negotiable. This is an instruction the nurse has to get right every time. Tetracyclines love to bind to things like calcium, iron, and magnesium.
So that means you have to tell the patient.
You have to tell them to avoid taking tetracyclines with milk or antacids or iron supplements.
Mm.
If they take them together, the drug binds with those minerals and forms these clumps in the GI tract.
Which means the drug never gets absorbed.
It's not absorbed. The therapy completely fails. The patient might as well be taking a sugar pill while the infection just gets worse.
Yeah.
You have to separate the doses by at least a couple of hours.
Okay. And there are two other really visual, irreversible side effects we need to talk about.
Yes, one with the sun and one with age.
Right.
First, they cause severe photosensitivity.
Yeah.
You have to counsel the patient, tell them to strictly avoid the sun, use strong sunscreen, wear protective clothing, even on a cloudy day.
And the second one?
The second is that they are absolutely contraindicated in kids under 8 and in pregnant women. They cause permanent, pretty ugly discoloration of the teeth, and they could inhibit bone growth. It's because of that same love for binding with calcium.
Are there other high alert effects in adults we need to watch for?
Well, GI upset is common. But more seriously, you monitor for signs of liver toxicity, hepatotoxicity, and something called intracranial hypertension. And one more thing. Always give the pill with a full glass of water and have the patient stay upright for a bit.
Why is that?
To avoid esophageal ulceration. The pill can get stuck and literally burn a hole in the esophagus. It's a simple but really critical point of patient education.
Okay, let's move across the factory floor to the other target, the 50S subunit blockers, starting with the macrolides. Erythromycin, azithromycin?
Right. These also stop protein synthesis, but they do it on the larger 50S subunit. They bind to it and basically block the enzyme that adds new amino acids to the chain. They just stop the assembly line.
And clinically, these are huge. I mean, they're often first line for things like community-acquired pneumonia.
They are. And they're a vital alternative for anyone with a penicillin allergy. They're great for pharyngitis, sinusitis, all those common respiratory infections when you can't use a beta-lactam. Azithromycin, the Z-Pak, is super popular because you can take it once a day.
Let's talk about the major red flag with this class, though, the cardiac risk.
This is a really high alert topic. It means you have to be meticulous. You have to review the patient's entire history and all their current medications. Macrolides carry a significant risk of QT interval prolongation.
Can you break that down for us? Why is a prolonged QT interval so dangerous?
Sure. The QT interval on an EKG is the time it takes for the heart's ventricles to recharge after a beat. When that time is prolonged, the heart muscle is vulnerable. It can lead to a really chaotic, life-threatening arrhythmia called torsades de pointes.
And that can lead to cardiac arrest.
It can, very quickly. So you just can't give these to patients who already have a long QT interval or who are taking other drugs that also prolong it.
And the drug interaction profile is a minefield because of the liver enzymes.
A total minefield. Erythromycin and clarithromycin are potent inhibitors of the CYP3A4 enzyme system. And that system metabolizes a huge number of other drug statins, anticoagulants, you name it.
So if you block that enzyme,
the levels of those other drugs can just skyrocket to toxic, even fatal levels. The nurse's job here is to do a really thorough medication reconciliation. It's critical.
And what about common side effects?
Oh, GI upset, big time. Erythromycin in particular is notorious for causing nausea, cramping, and diarrhea because it revs up GI motility.
Okay, so our last 50S blocker is the lincosamide class, and the main drug there is clindamycin.
Right. Clindamycin hits that same 50S subunit target, stops protein synthesis. It can be bacteriostatic, meaning it stops growth, or bactericidal, meaning it kills, just depending on the dose.
What's the special niche for clindamycin? What makes it indispensable?
Its greatest strength is its incredible effectiveness against anaerobic bacteria.
So the bugs that live in low oxygen environments.
Exactly. Deep abscesses, dental infections, things like that. It's the go-to drug for bone and joint infections, bacterial vaginosis, and it's also used to prevent endocarditis in certain patients.
Okay, so the moment a nurse sees an order for clindamycin, there is one specific, very dangerous GI issue that should immediately pop into their head.
Absolutely. This is the big one. The highest risk adverse effect is the potential for severe Clostridioides difficile-associated diarrhea, C. diff, CDAD.
And why is the risk so high with this particular drug?
Because clindamycin is so good at wiping out all the normal, healthy bacteria in the gut. And when you do that, you create this perfect empty environment for C. difficile to move in, take over, and start producing toxins.
Which causes a terrible colitis. So what is the nurse assessing for? This isn't just normal diarrhea.
No, you are looking for severe, persistent, watery, often very foul-smelling diarrhea, abdominal cramps, fever. If the patient develops this on clindamycin, you stop the drug immediately, and they'll likely need to be treated for the C. diff.
Any other organs to watch with clindamycin?
You want to monitor liver function on long-term therapy, and a common side effect is a metallic taste in the mouth. But nothing. Nothing trumps the risk of CD80. That is the number one alert for clindamycin.
All right, so we've hit the protein factories. Let's move on to what is probably the oldest and most reliable target in antibacterial pharmacology, the cell wall itself.
Yes, and this brings us to the absolutely massive foundational beta-lactam class. This covers penicillins, cephalosporins, and the big guns, carbapenems.
And they all work because of that signature beta-lactam ring in their structure.
Right. Their mechanism is just brilliantly destructive. They stop the final stage of cell wall synthesis. They do it by binding to enzymes called penicillin-binding proteins, or PBPs.
And why is that so fatal for the bacteria?
Well, the PBPs are what create the crosslinks that give the peptidoglycan a wall its strength and rigidity. When the beta-lactam drug binds to them, that cross-linking is blocked.
So the wall gets weak and poof.
Poof is a pretty good word for it.
Yeah.
The cell wall becomes weak. Water rushes in because of osmotic pressure, and the cell just bursts.
Yeah.
It lyses the bactericide.
Okay, this is a huge class, so let's talk about the scope. Penicillins are sort of the starting point.
They are. The original penicillins are great for gram-positive organisms. Strep throat, pneumococcal pneumonia. Then you have the cephalosporins, which we group into generations.
And as the generations go up, the coverage generally gets better for gram-negatives, right?
Exactly. First generations are great for skin infections, mostly gram-positive. By the third generation, you have excellent gram-negative coverage, and critically, many of them can cross the blood-brain barrier.
Which makes them essential for treating things like meningitis.
Absolutely. And then you get to the top of the pyramid, the carbapenems. Drugs like imipenem, they have the broadest spectrum of all. They are reserved for the most severe multi-drug-resistant infections. You don't just use these for anything.
So for this entire massive class of drugs, the number one highest stakes nursing alert is always going to be hypersensitivity.
It is mandatory. Before you give any beta-lactam, especially penicillin, you must thoroughly assess the client for a history of allergy.
And you have to be aware of cross-sensitivity, too.
Yes. There can be cross-sensitivity between penicillins and cephalosporins, though we now know the risk is lower than we used to think. But if you're giving these IV, you are watching that patient closely for any sign of anaphylaxis.
Swelling, hives, drop in blood pressure.
All of it. It's an immediate, high-priority intervention.
Okay, so beyond allergies, there's a really specific and kind of unusual red flag with the carbapenems that involves the central nervous system.
This is a critical one, especially with imipenem. It's known to lower the seizure threshold.
So it can make seizures more likely to happen.
It can. So it's contraindicated in patients who already have a history of seizures or other CNS disorders. And you have to use extreme caution if they're on other anti-seizure meds, because you could trigger a breakthrough seizure.
And what about common, less severe side effects?
You'll see the standard GI upset. And because you're wiping out bacteria, superinfections are common. So you watch for things like oral thrush or vaginal candidiasis.
Okay, next up, the glycopeptides. And the big one here is vancomycin, our rescue agent for those really tough gram-positives, especially MRSA.
Vancomycin is absolutely critical for serious resistant gram-positive infections. And its mechanism is really unique. It also targets the cell wall, but it does it differently than the beta-lactams. Instead of hitting the enzymes, it binds directly to the building blocks themselves, the D-alanine part of the peptidoglycan precursors. It physically gets in the way so the crosslinks can't form.
It blocks the delivery of the building materials?
A perfect way to put it, and its uses reflect how powerful it is. Abivanc is for MRSA, bacteremia, endocarditis, bad pneumonias. The oral form is only used for C. diff in the gut.
Now, vancomycin is famous, or maybe infamous, for having a very narrow therapeutic index.
It is. The dose that works is very, very close to the dose that's toxic.
And that means we need specific lab monitoring.
Correct. The nurse's role here is absolutely crucial. You have to monitor trough levels. That's the lowest concentration of the drug in the blood, drawn right before the next dose is due.
And you do that to avoid the two major toxicities?
Exactly. Severe nephrotoxicity and ototoxicity. Kidney damage and ear damage. You monitor kidney function labs like BUN and creatinine every day. Ototoxicity can cause permanent hearing loss. If that trough level creeps up too high, the risk for both of those things goes way up.
And the final critical nursing intervention with vancomycin is all about the infusion rate.
Yes. You must infuse IV vancomycin slowly. We're talking over at least 60 minutes, sometimes longer.
Because if you push it too fast.
If you push it too fast, you trigger vancomycin flushing syndrome or red man syndrome. It's this massive histamine release that causes intense flushing, itching, a huge drop in blood pressure. It can even cause cardiac arrest. Slowing the infusion prevents it.
Let's switch gears now to the DNA integrity disruptors. We're talking about the fluoroquinolones like ciprofloxacin and levofloxacin.
Right. So these drugs bypass the cell wall, they bypass the protein factories, and they go straight for the genetic blueprint of the bacteria.
How do they do that?
They inhibit two critical enzymes called DNA gyrase and topoisomerase the feed. The bacteria needs these enzymes for its DNA to unwind, copy itself, and make repairs. If you block them, the bacteria can't replicate.
And they're really good at getting into tissues, which makes them very useful.
Fantastic tissue penetration. Lungs, prostate, bone. They're great for complicated UTIs, some pneumonias, And they even have excellent oral bioavailability, so patients can switch from IV to pills easily.
But there is a huge but. Their adverse effect profile is extremely high risk, and it led to a major FDA warning about the musculoskeletal system.
This is a massive public safety issue. Fluoroquinolones carry an increased risk of tendonitis and tendon rupture.
Most commonly the Achilles tendon.
Most commonly the Achilles, yes. The risk is highest in older adults, patients with kidney problems, and anyone who is also taking corticosteroids.
So what's the nursing action? What do you do if your patient on Cipro says their calf really hurts?
You stop the drug and you report it immediately. Any severe muscle soreness or joint pain is a red flag. And this is also why we generally avoid them in kids, because of concerns about potential cartilage damage.
And we're back to that cardiac risk again, just like with the macrolides.
Unfortunately, yes. They can also cause QT interval prolongation, so you have to use the same caution. Check the patient's cardiac history, check their other meds.
And finally, that cation interaction issue pops up again, just like with the tetracyclines.
It's another critical administration point.
Yeah.
You cannot give fluoroquinolones with antacids, iron, or calcium, or multivitamins that contain them.
Because it blocks absorption.
It binds it all up in the gut, and the drug is useless. So the nurse has to be really careful about scheduling those doses, separating them by several hours to make sure the drug actually gets absorbed and can work.
Okay, we're in our final section now, metabolic inhibitors and the anaerobic specialists. Let's start with the sulfonamide derivatives, and the big one here is TMP-SMX or Bactrim.
Right. TMP-SMX is a great example of a synergistic combination. It's a true 1-2 punch against bacterial replication.
And it does that by blocking the folate synthesis pathway?
It does. It blocks it in two separate places. The sulfamethoxazole part hits the first step, and the trimethoprim part hits the next step. So by blocking two sequential steps in a critical pathway, you completely shut down the bacteria's ability to make nucleic acids and reproduce.
Clinically, it's a workhorse. It's first line for uncomplicated UTIs.
It is. We also use it for bronchitis exacerbations, a specific type of pneumonia in immunocompromised patients, and some skin infections.
Now, the number one red flag here is immediate. It's related to that sulfa part, and it can be fatal.
The primary contraindication is a known sulfa allergy. But the most terrifying adverse effect is the development of Stevens-Johnson syndrome, or SJS, and toxic epidermal necrolysis, TN.
So for the nursing students listening, what does SJS or TIN look like, and what is the immediate urgent response?
These are severe, potentially fatal skin reactions. The patient's skin and mucous membranes start to blister and slough off. It looks like a severe burn. The absolute critical nursing intervention is this. The medication must be stopped immediately at the very first sign of any rash.
A new rash on Bactrim is a medical emergency.
It is an emergency. You stop the drug, you call the provider. Full stop.
What are some of the other serious risks?
Hydration is key. The drug can form crystals in the urine crystal area, which can damage the kidneys, so you have to encourage plenty of fluids, and you monitor blood counts, because it can cause blood dyscrasias.
Okay, moving on to our specialist for those deep, low-oxygen infections, the nitroimidazoles, like metronidazole.
Metronidazole is a fantastic drug for targeting anaerobic bacteria and also some protozoal diseases. And its mechanism is really cool. It's a prodrug.
Meaning it has to be activated first?
It has to be activated. And that activation only happens in an anaerobic, low-oxygen environment. Once it's activated, it forms these toxic metabolites that literally break the strands of bacterial DNA.
And it's used for things like intra-abdominal infections, C. diff.
C. diff, bacterial vaginosis, certain protozoal infections like giardiasis. It gets into most body tissues really well, including the central nervous system.
Okay. Let's get to the most famous, most important patient education point for metronidazole.
This cannot be overstated. For patient safety, clients must absolutely avoid all alcohol during therapy and for at least a day or two after the last dose.
And if they don't, they get a disulfiram-like reaction. Describe that for us.
It's miserable, and it can be dangerous. The drug blocks the metabolism of alcohol, so a chemical called acetaldehyde builds up. The patient gets severe nausea, violent vomiting, intense flushing, a terrible headache.
So you have to educate them to avoid all forms of alcohol.
All forms. Cough syrups, some mouthwashes. You have to be very clear about it.
Any other key monitoring points?
A metallic taste is really common, and it can cause a harmless darkening of the urine. But for more serious effects with prolonged use, you're monitoring for neurological issues like neuropathy. And it can significantly increase the effect of warfarin, so you have to monitor the INR very closely to prevent bleeding.
Okay, our final class, the aminoglycosides, like gentamicin, This brings us back to the ribosome, but it works differently from the tetracyclines.
It does. Aminoglycosides also bind to that 30S ribosomal subunit, but instead of just blocking it, they cause a misreading of the mRNA code. So the bacteria ends up producing junk proteins that are useless or even toxic to itself. It's a very effective bactericidal mechanism.
And they get high concentrations in the blood and urine, which makes them great for serious gram-negative infections.
They're crucial for septicemia, complicated UTIs, bad hospital-acquired pneumonias. They also have what's called a post-antibiotic effect, which is great. It means they keep suppressing bacterial growth even after the drug level has dropped.
But just like vancomycin, these are heavy-duty drugs with a massive risk profile, and it focuses on the kidneys and the ears.
It does. Aminoglycosides have that classic dreaded duo of toxicities, nephrotoxicity and ototoxicity, kidney damage and ear damage. The ototoxicity can affect both balance and hearing.
So just like vancomycin, that means stringent lab monitoring is mandatory.
It is non-negotiable. To walk that line between effective and toxic, you have to monitor peak and trough levels. Peak levels, drawn after the dose, tell you if it's high enough to kill the bacteria. Trough levels, drawn before the next dose, tell you if the body is clearing it properly to prevent that cumulative organ damage.
And you're watching kidney function tests the whole time.
Every single day. And there are a couple of key contraindications. You avoid them in patients with myasthenia gravis because they can cause neuromuscular blockade.
Mm.
And you use extreme caution in pregnancy because of the risk of fetal ototoxicity.
Wow. Okay, that was a lot of information.
It was. But if we try to synthesize all of this, the core high-stakes nursing responsibilities really start to emerge as a consistent safety checklist, not just a random list of facts.
Right. It's not about memorizing. It's about seeing the patterns, like the absolute need to check for that sulfa allergy to prevent SJS, or looking at the EKG and the med list for QT prolongation before you give a macrolide or fluoroquine alone.
And that non-negotiable rule of counseling patients about alcohol avoidance with metronidazole.
And then there's that specialized function of pharmacokinetics. The absolute necessity of trough monitoring for vancomycin and the aminoglycosides to prevent them from destroying the kidneys or hearing.
Exactly. That's where the science of pharmacology meets patient safety at the bedside.
So the big nuggets to carry forward from this are those specific danger zones. The terrifying risk of CDAD with clindamycin. The hidden cardiac risks of multiple classes, the sudden severe tendon rupture risk with the fluoroquinolones.
And we can't forget the simple things that prevent the therapy from failing in the first place.
Like separating tetracyclines and fluoroquinolones from calcium and iron.
Exactly. Those small details are what make sure the patient actually gets the benefit of the drug we're giving them.
This whole deep dive just reinforces how much clinical weight a nurse carries every time they administer one of these drugs.
It does. And given the risk of organ injury across almost all of these classes, hepatotoxicity, nephrotoxicity, it always brings us back to that core principle of safe practice, antibiotic stewardship.
Meaning we shouldn't just keep a patient on the broadest spectrum drug if we have a more targeted option.
Exactly. And that's our final thought for you to consider. When you think about how hard these drugs are on a patient's liver and kidneys and how they drive resistance, how profoundly does that risk of drug-induced injury reinforce the principle of narrowing the antibiotic spectrum the second you get culture results back?
The goal isn't just to kill the bug.
It's to minimize the collateral damage to the host. Think about that responsibility the next time you hold a powerful syringe.